welcome to Come and Play, a geeky, kinky podcast. Come and Play explores all things sex toys, kink, feminism, geek life, and gaming culture. My name is Elia Winters, and I'm an erotic romance novelist. In addition to this podcast, I also run a blog at eliawinters.com. This episode has a few different key topics. I'm going to talk about my trip to Michigan and some of the new stuff that's on TV, but I'm primarily focused on astronomy and butt plugs. Yep, meteor shower, eclipse, and anal August. Buckle up, folks. Here we go. Some new and exciting things have been happening in my life. I'm a teacher, and it's summer vacation right now, at least for a few more weeks. I know that a lot of schools elsewhere in the country have already gone back to school, but their summer vacation starts in, like, May, and I went all the way to June 21st, so I don't feel particularly bad for them. My summer vacation has actually been pretty crazy. I've been going away a lot, rocking with the work hard, play hard mentality, and while it's awesome, it also means my summer has been flying by. The big trip that I just returned from is a week in Michigan. My husband and I drove out there with a friend of ours. Road trips are a test for any relationship, whether it's a friendship or a marriage. You can learn a lot about a person by spending 12 straight hours in a car with them. Like, a lot. More than you want to know. Also, their bladder habits. And your own. Like, wow, I need to pee every hour and a half on a road trip. That's fun. Also, my husband doesn't like music on road trips, which is some sort of cyborg problem, because who doesn't like music while they're driving? I think it's probably more the case that he doesn't like my music, but fuck you, dude. My music is awesome. When I travel with students, I make them listen to all of my music. It's a weird and eclectic collection of everything. A grab bag. Just like this podcast episode in some ways. We did all 5 Great Lakes in just a week on our trip. In fact, we did 3 of them within 24 hours, but the other 2 we got on the trip in and out. On the way in, we went through the states instead of going through Canada, so we hit Lake Erie. And then we did Huron, Superior, and Michigan in one 24-hour period, and Ontario on the way out of Michigan, on our way to Niagara Falls. Swimming in all 5 Great Lakes has been an item on my bucket list for a long time, so I'm super glad we got to do it. That said, Lake Superior is extremely cold. I was nearly hyperventilating as we ran in. I didn't exactly go slow. If you go slow, you change your mind. I'm trying to do more scary things fast. I did a polar plunge a few years ago, and that's definitely not something you want to do slowly. Now, I'm not advocating making permanent decisions fast, like I didn't decide to get a tattoo fast or to pierce tons of things on my body. Like, those were all long-term decisions. But spur-of-the-moment, impermanent things? Yeah, do those fast. Cold water is something that should be done fast. Michigan was an awesome vacation. It was busy, though. We were going pretty much from the time we got up till the time we went to bed every day. There was very little downtime, except for the time we were spending driving. Midwesterners, your states are fucking huge. Michigan was just giant. I feel like we'd drive forever, and we would still be in Michigan. I'm from Massachusetts, and you can drive through 6 states in like 6 hours if you plan it properly. But you can drive 6 hours in Michigan and still be in Michigan. I grew up down south in Florida, and I made the Florida to Massachusetts drive many times, so I was prepared for big states. Driving through the Carolinas and Virginia is a special kind of highway endlessness. Michigan reminded me of that, but a lot prettier. I'm sorry, southern states, you are not in my heart. Michigan is similar latitude to Massachusetts, so there were a lot of familiar similarities. The climate, the foliage, even the fact that they do apples and maple syrup. Michigan is like Massachusetts's Midwestern cousin. While we were there, we visited the Henry Ford Museum and Greenfield Village because my friend used to work as a singer at Greenfield Village. Being in both of these places made me think a lot about how technology has evolved and what geekiness looks like and has looked like throughout history. Henry Ford, for instance, was so passionate about so many things, and he also had money, so he was able to realize a lot of his dreams. Having money makes a big difference in who gets remembered or forgotten by history. Money and also privilege. Henry Ford was a racist. He's a perfect candidate for that whole "your fave is problematic" meme, but it is impossible to discount the impact he made on the landscape of America. It's kind of crazy to think of that kind of impact by just one person, just revolutionizing the way we do business. And that kind of paradigm shift is happening right now, too. The internet is changing the landscape of business. It's exciting, but it's also frightening. I don't know what things are going to look like in another 10 years. We've moved away from the type of industry where you can work for a company for 40 years and they take care of you. We're in a gig economy, and people are cobbling together income from a handful of different jobs and side hustles. And then, like, look at Patreon, for instance. It's this new era for supporting the arts, and it's all crowdfunded. It feels like everything's crowdfunded now, actually. I don't mind that, except when I'm supposed to crowdfund surgery, because insurance doesn't cover it. That's fucked up right there. I think geekiness is connected to all these ideas, though, because it's about passion, and finding a thing you love and then doing it, and hopefully finding someone to pay you for it. A few key people have made significant impacts on society just by fully realizing their geekiness. I don't think that's my calling. I'm not going to revolutionize the world with erotic romance and this geeky, kinky podcast and blog. But I don't know. It still feels good. It feels like I'm doing something meaningful and fun. And I hope you all enjoy hearing from me a couple times a month. So, with that in mind, let's talk about some geeky topics. Some exciting things are happening in the world of TV geekdom right now. As you probably know, Game of Thrones is back. My husband and I just got caught up on this season, but don't worry, I'm not going to spoil anything for you. I do have some spoilers for stuff from like a couple of seasons ago, so if you're that far behind, I'm going to spoil it for you, but in general, no spoilers from season 6 or so far season 7. It always takes us a little while to get caught up. I love Game of Thrones, but it's not really something I could binge watch right before bed because then I will have nightmares, and nobody likes nightmares. So there's a cutoff point in the evening beyond which I can't keep watching. And as a result, I tend to be more sympathetic about requests for not having spoilers since frequently I'm way behind on most of the shows I like. In general, I have a mixed relationship with Game of Thrones. Like, I've got mixed feelings. I read all the books a couple of years ago, when the series was first coming out. What happened was I watched all of season 1 with the husband, and then I went and binge-read all of the books. I read all of them within a month. May. It was the month of May. And that's a lot of pages. I was not a good partner during that month. I pretty much ignored my husband entirely. But it's been a few years since I read them, and yet when they started deviating from the books in the show, I was like, okay, I can sort of see why you're doing this, but one way in which Game of Thrones keeps deviating is in its glorification of rape. I'm going to talk about rape a little bit, not in its specificity, but just the fact that it exists and how the show has been using it. So if that triggers you, just skip ahead a couple of minutes, and once you've got me talking about Silicon Valley, you will be safe. Silicon Valley. Not Silicon Valley. We're not talking about tech nerds getting boob implants. Although I'd kind of be into that show. So anyway, back to Game of Thrones. I'm not saying that Game of Thrones presents rape as a good thing, because it's not, but the show sort of revels in how horrible it is. It's almost like the showrunners are just like trying to make you look away. And I'm not saying that rape has no place in media, but there's a line between using it as a plot device and using it as like the primary plot device. There's so much rape in Game of Thrones. They build in rape almost like it's a shortcut for character development, and that shit gets old really fast. The Song of Ice and Fire books also have rape, but it's generally not on the page. Actually, it's been a few years since I read them. I might be wrong about that. Somebody feel free to correct me. I do know that a lot of the sex becomes way more problematic in the books because all the characters are a lot younger. But the show does change consensual sex from the books to rape in the show. There's a scene between Jaime and Cersei in an earlier season that's consensual in the books, but definitely forced in the show. Jaime can't come back from that kind of character flaw, in my mind. It makes his character pretty damn irredeemable. And I know the show wants a lot of problematic people to be redeemable, but I can't really redeem rapists, and they turn Jaime into a rapist. I'm sorry, Game of Thrones. I really liked the character, and I want to like the character, but I can't just forget and overlook that. Also, it's still not enough to make me quit the show. I gotta confess to that. I really like this show, but, you know, I can like a thing and still criticize it. There's another thing, like, way back in season one, we had Daenerys married off to Khal Drogo, and in the book, she's literally 13 years old, so that's a big issue. But also in the book, their wedding night sex is not this horrific, painful rape thing like it is in the show. If you ignore the age gap, and we're continuously asked to ignore the age gap in fantasy, which is its own issue, but if you ignore that, then it's this interesting, tender, and definitely consensual sex, where Khal Drogo is actually a pretty great and considerate lover and isn't interested in forcing her to have sex with him. Now, they change that in the show, and so we get this narrative of her learning to seduce him and to make sex pleasurable, and they fall in love. But in the book, they were pretty much into each other from the very beginning. And I guess they wanted a different arc for the two of them in the show, but adding rape in, where rape didn't exist, is always a weird choice, and yet it's a choice that Game of Thrones keeps making. I still fucking love watching the show. I love seeing these characters develop over time. I want to see where it's all going. For the first few seasons, I knew everything because I'd read the books. Like, some of the characters were combined, but I knew there weren't going to be, like, big drastic changes. And now, though, they've gone totally off book to make up for the fact that George R.R. Martin has the writing speed of a particularly slow glacier, and the show has to continue on its own. So he gave them his blessing and was like, Godspeed, go fuck shit up. And they most definitely are going to do that. So now nobody's safe. It's like the goddamn Trump presidency. Only there's a lot fewer idiots in Game of Thrones. The idiots in Game of Thrones tend to die, and the ones in our current presidency just keep getting promoted. In addition to the new season of Game of Thrones, we finally have the start of Rick and Morty season 3. If you aren't watching Rick and Morty, I would argue that it is one of the smartest shows on television right now. Yeah, it's crude, but it's crude in less of a shock factor way than South Park or similar. The satire is great, and the overall writing itself is wonderful. I'm so glad my friends introduced it to me. Like all other fans, I've been waiting anxiously for season 3. They released episode 1 early, but the actual series didn't start until just this past weekend. And it's awesome so far. Also, it's pretty dark. But I'm not really surprised. Rick and Morty has always been pretty dark. It's an interesting combination of light and dark. The form of the cartoon itself, especially one that's ridiculously drawn without much attempt at realism, that lets the show get away with a lot darker content than if it were live action. My husband and I are also really into Silicon Valley, which is another show on HBO. Silicon Valley follows a tech startup company from its origins. It's a comedy, and the cast is mostly stand-up comedians and improvisers who were friends before the show. And they're also still friends while they're filming, apparently. And that kind of energy really builds up the show itself. It's created by Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead fame. And whatever you might think of Beavis and Butthead, Mike Judge is a very talented guy. Office Space, for instance, is another Mike Judge piece, and that movie is infinitely rewatchable. Even though it hinges a lot on real-life technology, I mean, they're planning for the Y2K bug, and that tech has evolved so far beyond what's depicted in the movie, but the bullshit of people has not evolved, and printers still suck. So Mike Judge is a talented guy, and his talent is reflected really well in Silicon Valley. The characters are hilarious. It was very much a sausage fest to begin with in the first season. There was like one woman and her role was like, I'm your emotional support. I'm your guidance. Blech. But over the next few seasons, women started to play more significant roles in the show. I guess they didn't add more women as a response to the gender difference. Judge has been really cavalier about it. He's like, hey, women aren't predominant figures in the tech industry. It's mostly guys, and this is a show about the tech industry, so women aren't going to be prominent. And that's kind of a bullshit answer, because art has the potential to affect life, not just to imitate it. But even so, Silicon Valley has gotten somewhat better about including women. And they're also addressing sexism, and they're doing it in some really funny ways. Like, they want to hire an engineer, and the lead candidate is a woman. And they want to hire her because she's the best person for the job. But they're also happy she's a woman. But they don't want to be thought of hiring her because she's a woman. It's all really complicated, and it's played really humorously on the show. The ups and downs of the show itself are brilliant. We rewatch episodes all the time because the humor is fantastic. So if you aren't watching Silicon Valley, you should start. Just get yourself an HBO Go. On to a different kind of geeky talk, and something I'm really excited about, and that's the astronomy part of today's show. Specifically, meteor showers and eclipses. First, the Perseid meteor shower. That's going to peak right around August 12th this year. And if you don't know what causes meteor showers, that's okay. Lots of people don't know. Back in college, I was a double major in astronomy, but only for about a year or so. I ended up dropping my major to a minor after I finished multivariable calculus, because the thought of doing any math that is more difficult than multivariable calculus, that's a big hard limit for me. And because I realized I really suck at physics, and no matter how hard I tried to get better at physics, I was not improving. And you can't really be an astronomer if you're not also a physicist. So my major became a minor. But I did take a lot of cool astronomy classes, and I know some stuff. I haven't really talked about my geeky science background on this podcast yet, but there's a meteor shower and an eclipse coming up, so this seems like the perfect time. So, some sciencey stuff. You might know this, you might not. Bear with me. Comets. Comets, as you probably know, are continuously moving through our solar system and beyond our solar system. They tend to travel in orbits, and they leave a bunch of spaceship behind, because when they pass by the sun melts the ice and they leave debris. Dust, rocks, etc. When the Earth passes through the path of a comet, the tiny bits of spaceship fall through our atmosphere and burn up, and that produces meteor showers. Now, the Earth is pretty much always moving through patches of tiny spaceship, which is why you can get sporadic meteors basically any night. If you look up and you see a shooting star, that's some tiny bit of something getting burned up. Meteor showers are predictable because comets are predictable, and we know when we'll be passing through those debris fields. Fun comet fact. Halley's Comet is visible from Earth about every 75 years, like every 74 to 79 years. Samuel Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, was born just 2 weeks after the comet appeared in 1835. And many years later, as he was getting old, he said, and this is a direct quote, I came in with Halley's Comet in 1835. It is coming again next year, and I expect to go out with it. It will be the greatest disappointment of my life if I don't go out with Halley's Comet. The Almighty has said, no doubt, now here are these two unaccountable freaks. They came in together. They must go out together. And sure enough, he died on April 10th, 1910, just a day after the comet's reappearance. Now, isn't that crazy? I love that story so much because I love to think of Mark Twain just being this just stubborn guy who's like, no, I came in with it. I'm going to go out with it. And everyone's like, Mark, you're fine. Well, they'd be like Samuel. I don't know. Do they call him Samuel? Do they call him Mark? But they'd be like, hey, you're fine. And he's like, no, I shall leave with the comet. I don't know why I gave him that accent. He's a southerner. He wouldn't have whatever fucked up accent I just gave him. But I just love that story. Now, the last time Halley's Comet was visible was in 1986, but it was a pretty shitty year for comet viewing. It wasn't very bright. I was just turning 5, and I do remember my parents taking me out in the backyard to see it, because it was going to be the only time in their lives that they would see it. And they told me that I would probably see it once more in my lifetime. I don't know if I'm going to live into my 80s, but I plan to. And if that's the case, then yeah, I'll see Halley's Comet one more time. If you're listening to this and you're much younger than me, you probably will too. When it appears in 2062, it'll be much brighter than it was in 1986. So, back to meteor showers. A bit about terminology. A meteoroid is the thing in space. It's like a tiny asteroid. It's the bit of space debris. When it enters the atmosphere and creates light, that's a meteor. And if it hits the ground, it's a meteorite. So meteoroid, meteor, meteorite. If you've never watched a meteor shower, I gotta break it to you, they are not as exciting as television and movies might have led you to believe. The Perseids, which are the ones coming up, are going to peak at around 80 meteors per hour. That's slightly more than one per minute. It's not like 5 per second, like you might have imagined it to be. Or at least I always imagined it was going to be like a whole shower of meteors, not a trickle. But some years, depending on the way in which we pass through the debris field, it will be an especially strong meteor shower. And that's when they'll call it a meteor storm. I've never seen a meteor storm. But apparently back in 2002, the Leonid meteor shower, that's the one that happens in November, it was a meteor storm. And the peak rate of meteors was over 3,000 meteors an hour for half an hour straight, which is almost 1 per second. And that must have been incredible. Hopefully there'll be another meteor storm in coming years, because I would love to see that. If you're watching a meteor shower, or really anytime you're looking for shooting stars, you might see a really bright one. And it's just like a blazing bright shooting star. If you're not looking straight at it, it'll still catch your eye. And those are called fireballs. And they aren't that common, but they're really incredible. I got to see one last year during the Perseid meteor shower. The fireballs are caused by an extra large bit of space dust, and it takes longer to burn up, essentially. Some meteors, though, they don't burn up, and they hit the ground, becoming meteorites. Back when I was in undergrad, when I was still an astronomy double major, I heard about a program called ANSMET, or the Antarctic Search for Meteorites. I seriously considered applying to join it. ANSMET is a program that does pretty much what it sounds like it does. It goes all over the South Pole looking for meteorites. ANSMET workers drive skidoos all across the frozen ice, and they look for extraterrestrial rocks. And if that doesn't sound fucking amazing, you do not have the same sense of adventure that I do. But ultimately, maybe I don't really have that sense of adventure because I didn't apply. Mostly because it would mean being away from my loved ones for like 6 months. And the other reason is because they really don't take undergrads, so I would have had to be a graduate student. They do take graduate students and senior researchers. Just a few a year. You often have to like write letters for years on end before you get in. But if you're interested, and this sounds exciting, feel free to Google them. They're really easy to find. Anyway, they search in Antarctica because it's comparatively easy to see meteorites when the background is neutral, in this case, a big white field of snow and ice. Meteorites fall all over the world, but it's easiest to find them in places like Antarctica. There are also meteorite retrieval teams that look in deserts, for pretty much the same reason. It's big neutral space. ANSMET has collected over 21,000 meteorites in the last 40 years. They started back in 1976. And that's pretty awesome, if you ask me. You can also go on their website and read blog posts from members of the expeditions if you'd rather not actually go to Antarctica for a year, or 6 months, or however long they go, but you want a bit of a voyeur's glance into the experience. So now, when you watch the Perseid meteor shower, you'll have some more information. I hope you learned some things you didn't already know. Unfortunately, this year, the Perseids might be drowned out a bit by the moon. Moon phase plays a big part in how visible a meteor shower is, and the Perseids are coinciding with a moon that's just past full, which means you've got a fair amount of light from the moon obscuring some of the dimmer meteors. But they're still going to be visible, and you should go out and watch. The other big science news right now, aside from climate change, which is eventually going to destroy humanity if we don't get our shit together, is that we're having a total solar eclipse passing across the United States on August 21st. Sadly, it will not be passing anywhere near Massachusetts, where I live. I seriously priced out flights and driving time to make it down to Tennessee, which is the closest place where the eclipse is passing over in totality, but it is, let's say, fiscally undesirable for me to invest that kind of money, even if it's going to be awesome. At some point in my life, I will fly to wherever the total eclipse is, but it will not be this August. The eclipse is passing directly over the United States, though, and only the United States. So if you live within a few hours' drive of the event, you really should go. Apparently, Neil deGrasse Tyson says that a total solar eclipse should be on everyone's bucket list. And you don't want to disappoint one of our top science guys, right? Yeah, I didn't think so. But of course, don't stare at the eclipse. Get yourself some eclipse viewing glasses or one of those pinhole cameras or something. Back when I was in middle school, we had a partial solar eclipse where I was in Florida. And they gave us something so we could watch it. I don't really remember it that well. I think it was glasses. I do remember the eclipse, though, even though it was just a partial. And I remember the whole school standing outside. It was really cool. This sort of astronomical phenomenon is not an everyday occurrence. It's awesome if you get to be there when it happens. Okay, this episode has been heavily science-y and TV so far, but I can't leave out the sexy stuff. It's anal August. August, if you're into puns. I did not come up with that one. I did a whole episode on anal sex, and I mentioned anal toys, but I didn't go into too much detail on specific anal toys. So I'm going to talk about that with you today. There may be a little content overlap with previous podcast episodes, but we're cool with that, right? Okay, good. I have mentioned this in the past, but please, do not stick anything into your ass that doesn't have a flared base. You don't want to be that person in the emergency room who can't get the cucumber out, okay? Use a toy that's made for anal play. Any good, reputable company will tell you that a toy is or is not safe for anal, but the flared base is key. Also, a little bit about hygiene before we get too far underway. I'm just going to say it. Poo is a generally undesirable but fairly common side effect with anal play. If your diet is good and you're pooping regularly without constipation or diarrhea or anything like that, you will have little to no poo to deal with. The rectum does not store poo, except right before you have to go to the bathroom. So go poo when you have to, and ideally that will be a few hours before you do any kind of butt stuff. And if there's a little residue to deal with, that's part of it. Wash it off, sterilize your toys, go on your merry way. Enough said? I don't know, maybe not. Lots of people swear by enemas before doing anal play, but I'm not an expert on enemas. If there's interest, I'll do a bunch of research and talk about it on an upcoming podcast, but currently, that is not in the plans. Good? Good. On to the toys. Silicone. Not to be confused with Silicon Valley, but silicone is a popular material for anal toys. It's a popular material for all toys. It's usually dishwasher safe, and it can be sterilized by boiling. And because it's got some give to it, it's somewhat flexible and good for the anal beginner. I always recommend going to a local adult boutique if you've got one in your area, preferably one run by women, and seeing the toys before buying them, especially if you're new to it. Even with the dimensions posted online, it can be hard to picture what 1.5 inches wide looks like until you're holding it and going, oh my god, I can't shove that in my ass. So, anatomy of a butt plug. Generally, they have a tapered tip, so you can push it in easily. and then they get wider. And at some point before the base, they have a narrow neck. That's the part your sphincter closes around. And then there's the base, which keeps it from going in all the way. If you've never stuck something in your ass before, you should probably start with a finger before you go to a toy. Your anus has two sphincters, one just inside and one around the outside. You can learn to control the muscles of the outer sphincter. It's the one you control when you're trying not to fart in front of people. But you can't control the inner sphincter. So the outer sphincter, you can learn to relax it. But the inner sphincter is not under voluntary control. And if you're nervous, that's the one that's going to tighten up. If you put a finger just inside yourself, you can feel the internal sphincter. But when people talk about the importance of relaxation with butt play, it's mostly so you don't get the pain that's associated with an internal sphincter that's like, holy hell, that's an outdoor, don't do that. However, the anus can be an indoor too, and it can be really fun. You just have to take your time and remember that pain means something is wrong. If it hurts, stop, wait till the pain goes away, and go more slowly. Butt plugs are made to be inserted and to stay in place. That's why they have the neck and then the base. You can manually push and pull them in and out, but if that's your goal, then you probably want a narrow dildo with a flared base instead of a butt plug. If you put a butt plug in, you generally want it to stay in while you're doing something else, like masturbating or having intercourse or doing housework. I love wearing toys while I do housework. It makes housework way more interesting. Now, because the rectum does not make its own lube, you need to use lube for anal toys. Otherwise, you're going to tear the skin of your anus and your rectum, and you're going to end up with anal fissures. And that's not fun for anybody. If you're using a silicone toy, you can't use a silicone lube. They don't work together. You generally want a water-based lube in that case, like Sliquid. Sliquid makes a thicker water-based lube called Sassy that's supposed to be great for anal play, but I just stick with Sliquid C and I do fine. Your mileage may vary. There's a ton of Sliquids. Find one that works for you. It's worth investing in good lube, by the way. Many people have reactions to propylene glycol and glycerin, and that shit is everywhere in cheap lubes. You probably can't find good quality lube at your local drugstore. Go to a sex shop or order it online. Read the ingredients. You want to look for brands that are glycerin-free and paraben-free. Hell, I'll bet if you write to some lube companies, they'll send you free samples so you can try one before you buy. You can probably even tweet at them. Now, the thing about water-based lube is it's going to get absorbed by your body over time. So if you want to wear a butt plug for an extended period of time, like more than an hour, I don't know, it depends on your body, but if it's for a while, you want to take the toy out and re-lube it up. Trust me, and I speak from personal experience on this, you do not want to be trying to pull out a silicone butt plug when your lube has all been absorbed. It is not fun. For silicone butt plugs, I recommend the Little Flirt from Tantus. Tantus has a ton of butt plugs for sale, from beginner plugs to the giant A-bomb. Yes, that's its name. And they're a great company, so check them out. I am an affiliate for Tantus, so if you want to do me a solid, you can go to eliawinters.com and follow the Tantus link from there, instead of just going right to their website. Now, I'm still a fan of silicone butt plugs in general, because they're small and flexible and inexpensive. But I've become a much bigger fan of stainless steel plugs, specifically the ones by Enjoy. Now, I've talked about Enjoy on previous podcast episodes because they make some of my favorite dildos. I'm not an Enjoy affiliate right now, at least at the time I'm recording this, so I'm not getting anything to recommend them. I just love their stuff. They make a few different sizes of their plug, the Pure Plug. I think the one I have is the medium. They've got a small, medium, large, and then they have the Pure Plug 2.0, which is, let's just say, generously proportioned. They have a bit of a different shape from other plugs. Instead of being like a cone shape, they have a larger, bulbous head and a longer, thinner neck. They still narrow at the very tip for insertion, but not quite as much as a silicone plug generally does. What's awesome about stainless steel, though, and this is also true for glass toys, is that it's frictionless. If you've played with silicone toys, you know they can have a bit of a drag to them. That's minimized by lube, but it's still got some friction. And sometimes you want friction. But for anal play, I tend not to want friction. I want pressure and fullness instead. And that's why stainless steel is great. It's a heavy toy, so you know it's there. Plus, you can use silicone lube with a steel toy instead of a water-based lube. Silicone lube is not going to be absorbed into the body as quickly, so you won't have that painful drag from removing an unlubed toy. Or at least you won't have it as quickly. Enjoy plugs are not cheap, and because of this, I generally don't recommend them to anal beginners. But if you've been sticking some stuff up your ass for a while now, you should try a steel plug. They feel incredible. One of the other things to note about butt plugs is that all flared bases are not created equal. When I say flared base, most people think of a round base, like what you'd see on a harness-compatible dildo. And round bases are also what you see with those little jewel plugs, which are usually also steel, but they have a cute little gem or something on the base. Can I just say, live and let live, but I personally do not like those jewels. Maybe because I see them too much in the daddy dom little girl porn, which is not real little girls. DDLG is a kink. It's not my kink, but it overlaps with some of my kink, so I get it on my Tumblr dash all the time. Princess putting a sparkly jewel in her no-no hole is not arousing to me, even though I get that it is to others. Without that association, maybe I'd like the jewel, but frankly, I'm just not a fan of round, flared bases. The shape means it's going to press into my ass cheeks. If the base is wide enough that I'm not worried about it slipping inside, that means I'm also going to feel it in the place where I don't want to feel it, which is on the outside. Fortunately, there are different kinds of flared bases. If you look up the little flirt by Tantus that I mentioned earlier, or actually most of the Tantus plugs, you'll see that they have a narrow flared base, like a little canoe attached to the bottom. And that's not going to slip into your ass, but it's also not going to push into the sides of your bum, which is awesome. Enjoy is similar. They have a base that's shaped like a squashed donut, but it's vertical, not flat. So it fits between your cheeks, but it also is too wide for the toy to slip further inside. And it's got the added benefit of being easy to hook a finger into it to remove it. It's important to note that if you are a person with a vagina who likes being penetrated, you don't want the base of the anal plug to be so big that it hinders access to your vagina. Just some things to keep in mind. You know, I think that's about it for this episode. Thanks for bearing with me through the delay, and I'm glad you came back. If you're enjoying the podcast, recommend it to your friends, leave us a nice review, or support the Patreon at patreon.com/ElliaWinters. I welcome your emails at comeandplaypodcast@gmail.com. And as always, of course, stay geeky and kinky. Come and Play Podcast is produced by Ellia Winters. Like Ellia, the theme music is So Easy. It's by Jazzar and is being used under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. Check out more about Jazzar on betterwithmusic.com.